Hello, and welcome to episode 20 of Let Them Eat Cake. My name is Jack, my co-hosts are John and Ace. And what is this week's show about?
Today we're talking to my friend Khalid from Afghanistan. He has quite an interesting story. He's been back and forth throughout there. He's had quite a life, and he's currently in America. And we spent a lot of time looking for the right person to talk to about the fall of the Republic. And you know, someone who actually understands, who's lived through the entire campaign in Afghanistan and remembers, you know, back when the Taliban controlled it the first time. And those people are increasingly rare to find. One of the things we talk about is the death of the Al-Qaeda chief in Afghanistan. And you know, it's a very common topic on this show, and we now have officially word from Al-Qaeda that they have elected a new emir, and it's what we expected. It's going to be Saif al-Adel, which is going to be quite the interesting shakeup for Al-Qaeda, because it's so weird, because it's like you have to grade things on a curve, you know? But I would describe him as not a fundamentalist. And we're comparing him to, like, you know, like some really, really whacked out fundamentalist guys. Like, he's a very rational, strategic thinker. Like, but he has intense loyalty. He never questioned anything. Well, he did question a lot. He spoke out a lot. And that's what's very interesting and why we know so much about him. But, like, he wouldn't disobey orders or anything like that. So he was, like, known for his loyalty to the emirs of Al-Qaeda. And, like, he was so loyal that when bin Laden died, that's who they gave temporary power to, because, like, I don't know if this is a common thing or it's just Al-Qaeda system, but they need to get, like, all the votes from, like, leaders to, like, elect the new chairperson. 'Cause it's kind of democratic. And so there was somebody who was, like, resisting back then, and I guess he went, like, you know, probably broke this guy's wrists or something like that and got him to, like, submit to, like, the new emir of Al-Qaeda. But he's known for being extremely angry all the time, and more one of those people. He's more like a Ba'athist than he is, like, an actual, like, Al-Qaeda guy in a lot of ways. And he was a colonel in the Egyptian army.
I think it's really interesting how things are coming full circle. Just to kind of expand off of what you were saying earlier, oftentimes the EIJ, or Egyptian Islamic Jihad, which is what...
That's a really important point, because I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I want to bring this back. When I can't pronounce his name, Zahawi joined Al-Qaeda, there was only 8 guys left in EIJ. This guy was actually not one of them, I think. He was
and it kind of bring back to that, and just kind of, you know, the EIJ's merger with Al-Qaeda, just because of the circumstances they were in at the time. We all know that the guy who assassinated Sadat, Khalid al-Islambouli, one of the guys who led it, he was a former, I think he was a lieutenant in the Egyptian military. So, again, it's kind of just coming back full circle to, like, the Cold War, when certain facets of the Egyptian military were being radicalized because of the peace made with Israel. And I think it makes perfect sense as to why you would say he's a bit more of a rational thinker, because he likely is. He was likely more pissed off with the direction things were taking in Egypt than anything. And, you know, for a lot of these guys, and you can look at Iraq and Egypt as examples, for a lot of these guys, they were former military members in Arab military, and they were just not satisfied with the direction the country was turning, or they'd fallen out of favor somehow with higher ups in the military. And again, it kind of just goes to show that when you leave people with military training to their own devices, it can lead to some pretty scary shit. So I think this is just very interesting how it just ties right back to a lot of the stuff we've discussed on this show regarding how people in these Arab militaries get radicalized, and how these people advance through the ranks of Al-Qaeda and how they generally have a different perspective from, say, someone like bin Laden or Zawahiri, where it's kind of like they're very upper class kind of fundamentalists who use the cause, so to speak, the jihad, to maybe further some narcissistic goals, or, you know, some actual jihadist goals, whereas these guys are kind of more of like the nuts and bolts of the operation. They're the guys with the military training. They're the guys who understand how actually fighting a war would work. And because of their military training, much of it being Western training, they're a bit more rational. They're a bit more like they're less so much looking at like the cause and like this kind of like gung-ho idea of what the jihad and the cause is, and more so strategic areas of how to actually advance it. So yeah, I do think it is an interesting transition they've made, and the way it ties back just to so many topics we've covered on this show is just pretty interesting in my opinion. Yeah,
and you nailed it right at the end there, because he has always been Al-Qaeda's strategist. He's also like their like elite forces trainer. So what's interesting about him, he's the one guy who said 9/11 is a bad idea. And he was 100% right, because his forces got wiped out in a few months. So there is an entire theory that he is one of the principal people that decided that it would be a good idea to get America to invade Iraq. They talk about specifically like basically making like almost like a triangle where they want it to like be in the Levant and like pass through Iran and into Afghanistan, and like basically just make this line of instability where they spread America really, really thin. And so like management of savagery, which is like what the principal strategy for Daesh and Al-Qaeda, it all comes from him. And like it's expanded on by theorists and stuff like that.
And if you look at it, at the end of the day, in some facet or another, he is correct, right? Like, because of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, the U.S. was viewed less favorably. They were able to create that instability. They were able to like.
Interesting fact I was just reading. I have it in the episode coming out, because next week will be Iraq. And in there, I found a piece of Al-Qaeda strategy at the time. It said that they were specifically pushing to support the elections, knowing that the Shia would oppress the Sunni. So the Iraqi resistance were the ones shooting people trying to go to the polls. The Iraqi resistance were the people trying to stop people from going to those polls. Al-Qaeda were the ones who wanted the democracy to come.
Yep. And at the end of the day, like I was saying, it allowed them to kind of fight a war on their own terms. And for a long time, it really furthered their goals. And if you look at like kind of Zawahiri and his role later on after bin Laden died, a lot of people don't know this, but Al-Qaeda expanded after the death of bin Laden. Zawahiri did a lot of good work, quote unquote, to expand their goals in other regions. And a lot of that is due to this strategy employed by these more like strategic kind of, you know, military brain nuts and bolts type of people. So it'll be interesting to see what he does moving forward.
And speaking about fundamentalist shifts, I think we should be talking about what's going on in Israel and Palestine right now. Basically, we're seeing a lot of stuff, with a lot of attacks. These cars are being burned. I mean, I'm sure everyone has seen the images by now.
Yeah, and I mean, it's basically there was riots in the town of Zatara, which is south of Huwara, and it's close to an Israeli settlement that I can't pronounce. And so 95 people were like injured in some way, a lot of it from tear gas inhalation, burns. 9 families had to be relocated at because of these fires that were caused in the West Bank. And again, it kind of shows you, like, and by the way, 9 families. I don't know if you guys know how big a Palestinian family in the West Bank could be, but that's a lot of people. That's like a decent amount of people. And again, it kind of just shows you, and you see a lot of videos surfacing from Palestinian media. It is very clear that the settlers and the more fundamentalist people within Israel have been emboldened given the new government change, and they're more willing to try and stir up shit with Palestinians in the West Bank. And the way it's looking right now, even though Netanyahu is kind of urging people, you know, not to take, quote unquote, the law in their own hands, and not to resort to vigilantism, which is what a lot of the settlers do. It's clear to me that I think they're really trying to actually make a push to de facto annex the West Bank. I don't know what you guys think of that, but it seems this way to me.
It doesn't look good. And especially also, speaking of Israel, they bombed Iran again, and they're going to continue to bomb Iran. And everyone has told Israel that they're 100% behind them on bombing Iran. So while this is going on, bombing Iran, they're also accelerating tensions in West Bank. And it's really important that it's also that this stuff is like happening in the West Bank, because like the fact that a drone strike happened in the West Bank was huge. Like, that's just not something that happens there. Like, it shouldn't. And it shouldn't happen in Gaza either.
The Israeli government are just more brazen about the West Bank. And if anyone has been paying attention since, I guess, COVID, it is very clear that it seems that the tides of what we consider conflict in Palestine, like it used to be like, oh, okay, like Gaza is the hot spot, right? It's always been the hot spot. But now it is seemingly fully shifted towards the West Bank again. And
So, yeah, I think that we'll get into the interview, a nice fundamentalism type of day, because the interview is going to be all about that. We even like get real deep into drugs and are they forbidden, and are people hypocrites if they, you know, sell drugs to the West, even if they're Muslim and stuff like that. It's a very, very interesting episode on the contradictions of the Taliban and how exactly the radicalization works.
We have a weapon more powerful than the British Empire, and that weapon is our refusal to bow to any order but our own, any institution but our own.
Hi, everyone. My name is Khalid Wardak. For those who can't pronounce Hey, it's like Khalid, but you can say Khalid. Or DJ Kelly. I am from Afghanistan and I live in here in the United States for like almost 2 decades now, not 2 decades, but maybe 15 years. I am following up Afghanistan news closely, like many other Afghan diaspora, especially after the fall of the Republic in Afghanistan and the rise of Taliban and their comeback power. And that's when I actually started more like my activism, when those events took place. So that's basically my background story.
So let's kind of work back from, so recent events that have been really making the news have been women banned from university. And obviously we knew this all was coming, but for a while they've been selling us on this Taliban 2.0 thing. And they'll be like, oh, eventually we'll open up schools. Mm-hmm. We just have to figure out the uniform. So how does that make you feel looking at it from so far away?
Well, it's very, very painful, to say the least, actually to watch an entire generation of a country, of a nation, being deprived of their basic human rights, which is just education. And it even doesn't stop at education. It's basically banning female from all walks of life, if it's work. All the female who were government employees, they were laid off for the most part. Even the Ministry of Women Affairs, it was abolished. And instead of the Ministry of Women's Affairs, a new ministry was found by the name of Ministry of Virtue and Vice. And its job is just to repress women. Basically, every day there is new verdict. So just to answer your question, it's really frustrating and painful for the entire generation above sixth grade. You know, nobody is allowed to go to school, to university, or to their work or private courses. And you can imagine if the entire country, you know, these women, they will be raising future kids the future leaders of the country? And if they are illiterate, what can you expect the future of the country will be? And this is very dangerous.
Did you happen to be around when the last Ministry of Vice and Virtue was around?
I wasn't in Afghanistan back then, but I was very close. I was living in Pakistan back then. I was actually in Europe, but I was going back and forth to visit my family in Pakistan.
Yeah, a lot of people had to leave Afghanistan at that time.
Exactly. So. Yeah. My family left too. And, in the previous Taliban 1.0, the same Ministry of Vice and Virtue existed. They were doing very silly things like hanging TVs or radios, just like, capital punishment. They would have the stakes and they would measure if somebody's beard is not long enough based on a prescribed, length. They would send them to jail until they grow their beard and then they would leave.
Really, would I have made it? Am I good?
Oh, you're perfect. I won't pass the test. And ever since then, Taliban 2.0, things have been happening gradually. Like, it's not like overnight. They are opportunistically, one by one, taking all the rights. The women that they had, they started from school. Then they started laying off from their job in universities, parks, beauty salons in Balkh province in north. They had like small businesses in Herat. Women had, women-owned restaurants. They closed them all. But one thing women are allowed to is begging on the street. There are like literally thousands of women who are out of job, who doesn't have any means to support themselves and their kids. And they are out there asking people to buy them.
Oftentimes their husbands are dead.
Exactly. Yeah.
What are their goals with doing this? What's the point of doing this to women?
I wouldn't say that they are ignorant that they are doing this. They are not ignorant. The reason that they are not ignorant is that their leaders, they all live abroad. They live in Abu Dhabi, Dubai, Qatar, and their children, their daughters go to universities. They have master's degree, they have PhD degree in Pakistan, in Iran, Turkey, New Zealand, Switzerland, Qatar. All over, they go to elite universities. Even the spokesperson of the Taliban in Doha, Mr. Suhail Shaheen, his daughter, she goes to university, but she's also a football player. But in Afghanistan, women are not allowed to enter in a public park. It's forbidden. So you can see the hypocrisy of the regime. I don't believe that this is an ideological thing. It's just to exercise their dominance and power. And basically, take the way that Taliban can govern is when people are ignorant and they will listen to their ignorant ideology that they are based on. And if people are educated, they are not, an educated woman will not raise a Taliban. They will not raise somebody who is fighting. So, and when they close schools for girls, on the other front, they open madrasas. Now there are thousands of new madrasas all over Afghanistan. They converted schools and universities into madrasas. It's just process of indoctrination going on from the childhood until they graduate. And it's so brainwashing that can you imagine that you can just ask somebody, hey, can you put this suicide vest on you and blow up yourself and say, of course, and they just do it. That's the degree of the indoctrination. And their leaders, they know all well that women should be going to school and everything. And some people say that there are two fractions within the Taliban. One is like quote-unquote moderate or like good Taliban. The other one is like a hardliner. But in my personal view, this is all calculated moves, to me at least. So.
last week we were talking about the 10 points of fascism, Jack, and one of those points you asked me if the Taliban did something in the madrasa. Do you remember what that was?
It was everybody is educated to become a hero.
Yeah. Do they do that in the madrasas? They have that type of education where they're educating you to become a hero?
The way that they teach in madrasas is, first of all, they teach them not the true Islam, but an Islam that has been, you know, modified to fit the needs of the... All these madrasas are in Pakistan, and they are funded by ISI. So basically, all these madrasas are designed to support the ISI and Pakistan's big goal of influencing Taliban in Afghanistan. Because all these madrasas are located in Pakistan, they are directly in close collaboration with the Pakistan Army for recruitment and training and all of that. There are videos of them, you know, training them and all of that. It's something that nobody can deny. Even Pervez Musharraf, the former general who also took over and became president and so prime minister, he also acknowledges in his interview that they were supporting Taliban. And in large part, these madrasas were funded by the United States and the West and Saudi Arabia. So if we are talking about the source, we are here at the source of the funding. When there was the Soviet Union invasion of Afghanistan, it was the United States who flooded Pakistan with all these dollars, aids and military equipment and everything, and build all these madrasas where they would recruit all these fighters to fight the Soviet Union. And that's how the Soviet Union, you know, the Cold War ended. And then they left Afghanistan. They abandoned, just like now. It was in the 90s. And they led Afghanistan into civil war until Taliban came. And Taliban was also a phenomenon. Nothing in the region happens without the control of the United States and Pakistan. So, these madrasas are the source of the problem for Afghanistan.
And on past shows, we have gotten into this a little bit. So we've talked a little bit about the good Taliban and bad Taliban past with the old PM in Pakistan and all that. So, Ace, it sounds like you have a question.
Yeah, you're bringing up how these madrasas are kind of like pushing. Would it be correct to say like a Taliban narrative, like a pro-Taliban narrative as far as Islam is concerned and teaching about Islam?
Actually, if you study their books, the textbooks that they are studying to them, these are altered books. They are not like the true authentic religion of Islam. For example, in one of the books, in excerpts of the books, they teach them that women is not allowed to learn to write. Because if the woman knows how to write, then she will start writing secret love letters and have an affair. How stupid it could be to, you know, associate such a thing to the saying of the Holy Prophet. It's just a disrespect. In Islam, there is so numerous instances where seeking knowledge is emphasized. Actually, the very first verse of the Quran that descended upon Prophet Muhammad was to read. And we have, you know, there are sayings that the knowledge is compulsory upon man and woman. Seek knowledge, even if it's in China. At that time, China was considered to be the farthest place. So there is all these teachings in the Quran and in the sayings of the Prophet about the importance of knowledge and seeking education. But that's not relevant to Taliban. For Taliban, their own a twisted version of Islam is the true Islam, because, you know, in psychology, if you keep repeating something to somebody over time, this is their reality. They will start believing in it. And they start madrasas at as young as at age of 5 or 6, and they stay day and night. It's just like a boarding school kind of thing. And they go to their home, usually in remote places, like once or twice a year. And they are just left there at the mass indoctrination process going on, just producing suicide bombers and fighters who don't think for themselves. And whatever their mullah and mufti says, that's their reality and truth.
There's also a lot of abuse here, too.
Oh, yeah, yeah. There is a lot of abuse. We heard about the Catholic Church scandals, in Europe, in Northern America, and elsewhere, in Latin America. Guess what? Madrasas are not immune. Today, you know, people have cell phones, the smartphones, they take pictures. There have been several such shameful incidents were recorded on camera. And these were like mullahs who are training other Taliban who were engaging in pedophilia. That is really disgusting.
My next question would be kind of be going back to the madrasas are kind of pushing the Taliban narrative and whatnot. Are there any like imams or sheikhs or like muftis in Afghanistan who are Sunni and who are like kind of outspoken against the regime, or is it all just like everybody's kind of falling in line right now?
One thing that Taliban have banned is the free speech. Free speech by anybody, even if it's an Islamic scholar or just any person. And even they had a big gathering and say, if anybody is criticizing the Taliban regime, they are our enemy and they are a legitimate target. And that's why there are so many activists. People have gone to jail just for liking a post. So inside Afghanistan, people are silenced. People are afraid to speak out. And the only people who can speak out are outside Afghanistan, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think that's why online activism is the most important thing right now, because the Taliban are on Twitter and you can interact with them directly.
Yes. So I want to just give background, a big picture about like Taliban and where this phenomenon came from. The problem in Afghanistan, it really doesn't start with Taliban, or it even doesn't start with the 40 years ago. I'll just give you like a big picture of what happened. So Afghanistan is a victim of its own geographic location. It's located, quote unquote, they call it a buffer zone between the, back then it was Russian Empire, on the other side was British Empire. So obviously Afghanistan at that time, like over 300 years, the British Empire tried to conquer Afghanistan three times, but they defeated. But what they succeeded was taking part of a very large part of Afghanistan, which is now called Pakhtunkhwa, and annexed it with British India at that time. And they were saying, because we need to create a safe buffer zone so there's no threat from Russian Empire towards us. And that was basically the cousins on one side of the Durand line. They were separated. You know, just like the British, they drew straight lines in an African continent. You know, they just making borders, literally using ruler. That's how they divided the countries. So the same thing they did with Afghanistan. And when the British left, and it was left, Pakistan inherited it. The policy, same thing from...
That's literally... in it, we have an episode on the TTP, and that's literally what the guy said, is they inherited the system that they have.
Exactly, exactly. So they inherited it. And ever since, you know, Pakistan's creation, we had this border dispute with them. And back then, Afghanistan was a stable country. But when the Russian invaded Afghanistan 43 years ago, it was the perfect opportunity for Pakistan to infiltrate the way that it could never do before into every segment of the society. And the best way to infiltrate was religion, because Afghanistan are traditionally very devout Muslim people. And the way to break into fabric of the society was to introduce this twisted narratives of Islam and send them over. That's how they, by manipulation, first they created seven jihadi parties who were fighting for, well, in the beginning, they were fighting the Soviet Union. But when the Soviet Union left, they were fighting each other. And until, you know, as a result of the civil war, the country was in total ruins. And once they left, you know, they were all the product of Pakistan ISI, you know, trained there, they were housed there. Then it was Taliban 1.0. It was a direct product of them, trained in their madrasas. And then the Republic came, and even by the Republic, they were not like, you know, sitting idle, like during the 20 years, they were supporting them logistically, training, safe havens and everything. And this project is still going on until now, unfortunately. And, you know, until Pakistan does not stop these madrasas across the Durand line, we will continue to have these extremist people crossing over.
I just want to ask you a quick...
down and... Sorry, Ice, go on.
Jack, you go. You haven't asked a question in a while.
Yeah, go ahead, Jack.
Do you think that madrasas are necessary in any way? Do you think that they should be shut down and removed? Do you think that they should be regulated? Do you think that they should be... do you have any solution to solve these issues?
Very good question. So, you know, as I said, Afghanistan is traditionally a Muslim country. We always had madrasas in Afghanistan. And madrasas were not a problem the way it is now, because madrasas were, as you said, they were regulated. They were part of the government entity, and they would teach them not the extremism ideology, but the mainstream Islam. And the way to solve this is to basically approve all the curriculum that they are teaching to the madrasa, remove all the text which is based on all those extremist ideologies, which is not even the true version of Islam to begin with. Just as an example of the about the education of girls that I mentioned, that they are not allowed to read because they would write secret love letters to their lovers. You know, Islam is a very beautiful religion of like peace and coexistence. And from out of everything, they are just like focusing, modifying correct message into something that fits their agenda.
The question I wanted to ask, and you or John, correct me, because I could be completely wrong about this, but the question I wanted to ask was, why do you think Pakistan and the ISI want to influence and work with the Taliban in Afghanistan, but they don't seem to really tolerate the TTP, or as it's known, like Taliban and Pakistan and their borders? Like, what's the goal there?
You know, Pakistan is, on the surface, it looks a democratic government where elections happens, but in reality, it's a police state. At the end of the day, whatever the general says, that's the bottom line. We've seen so many examples, and you can also tell that from the creation of Pakistan in the like 60, 70 years, not one president has finished its term to the fullest. They have been coups or not, you know, the army steps in, no confidence. Anyway, to answer your specific question on the Pakistan, the reason Pakistan is creating all this problem is that, first of all, if Afghanistan is weak, they want to consider it as their own buffer zone to the Pakhtunkhwa, you know, the area of the bordering Afghanistan, because there is a new movement of PTM or other, you know, they want to quench any separatist movement or anything. So for that reason, they want to have, you know, access to Afghanistan's natural resources. Right now, Pakistan is everywhere. Our coal, Afghanistan, they are dying from coal. They don't have coal, or our coal is going cheap dirt to Pakistan. Same like all the stones, the expensive, the valuable stones, gems, all of those. If you see even the aid that Russia was sending oil to Afghanistan, they were even in the back channel, they were selling that oil to Pakistan, and then Russia found out and they stopped it altogether and said, I don't want to deal with you anymore. But in terms of TTP, it looks like TTP is a problem for Pakistan. But TTP and Taliban, they are both raised in the very same madrasas. They were raised by the very same teacher. They were classmates. And then one person will go to, will be stationed in one location and one in the other location. And this is called a controlled risk, because just like Taliban's leaders, who are all reporting to like their superiors in ISI and Pakistan ranks, the same thing with them. And it's a controlled risk because they, the areas which are bordering Afghanistan, which is called Pakhtunkhwa, at that time, they were self-governing places. Like the government would not be present there. They were self-ruling for like hundreds of years. And by creating, it's called manufactured crisis, they send their army and say, oh, there are terrorists now here in my western border, so I need to send my army. So they sent army all up to the Afghanistan soil, and it's basically to control the region that was previously not under their control.
So for anyone who wants a more in-depth conversation on the exact thing that he was just talking about, we do have an episode on the TTP and the recent, you know, uprising and operations and all that background stuff. But I wanted to talk about how people don't understand that when the Taliban took over, it wasn't the Afghan army or the NRF versus the Taliban. It was them versus Taliban backed by Pakistan. The way we're helping Ukraine with operational intelligence, we weren't providing the same thing to our Afghan allies. We were more focused on destroying our CIA facilities to get the hell out of there. So we left them blind, and then they're at the mercy of Pakistan.
Yes, yeah. Actually, the same story is repeating once again. And I believe the United States is making a huge mistake again. They let everything loose the very first time, and then 9/11 happened. And then I remember very vividly that there were like uproars for a commission to investigate the root causes of 9/11 and the terrorism. And it was George W. Bush and his team who stopped that bipartisan committee to dig into what really causes this. And it's all, you know, as I said in the very beginning, the funding of all these Talibanization, all these madrasas, it costs money. And Pakistan is a broke country. It's literally bankrupt as we speak. If it isn't for the United States on the IMF and like all these loans just to have it on the artificial life, just they want to keep it alive. How can they support all these madrasas? Obviously, the funding comes from the United States, from the West, from Saudi or from...
So I was about Saudi Arabia.
Yeah. So this is, you know, in Taliban, they promised that they will break their ties with Al-Qaeda and terrorist group. And they lied. You know, the Al-Zawahiri was killed in Kabul in... This is just the tip of the iceberg. And once there is another big terrorism incident happening, and then everybody will be saying, oh, you know, what happened here? And they don't know that, hey, it was you guys that handed over everything to such a group. So
do you think that the Taliban has potential to become a legitimate government, I guess you could say, in Afghanistan? Is that a potential, or do you think that they're just going to continue dwindling down the rabbit hole of extremism?
I don't think that they will become a legitimate government. First of all, legitimacy comes from the people that you govern. If you do now a poll in Afghanistan, I believe the overwhelming majority, like I would say even 90% of the country, do not want Taliban. All the foreign imposed governments, even if we start from the very beginning, so many governments have gone and gone. They didn't have legitimacy from the people. That's why they left. And even right now, there are some countries, I think Turkey was one of them, who was lobbying for the Taliban to be recognized, or some other countries who are right now. Russia is like talking about, you know, recognizing the possibility, but it wouldn't really matter even if one country or a few countries recognize them, because on the face of this planet Earth, I don't think that there is any other government that bans education or that bans half of the country literally from living.
How do you see it changing? What what potential situations could happen that might see opinion change in Afghanistan?
There are two changes that could, you know, tilt the scale. One is internal and one is external. So internal is people are already fed up. People are already, they don't like Taliban. They don't like the restrictions, men, women alike. But the problem internally is that there is no united leadership to stand behind and say, hey, this is the opposition. There are several opposition leaders, but not everybody is standing behind one person. So that's one problem. And for external, right now, everybody seems to be on the side of Taliban, the United States, the West. I don't see one single country that opposes Taliban. Well, on the surface, everybody will have their statements condemning closure of schools, condemning this. But hey, if you're condemning, then why are you sending them $40 million a week? They have the leverage to force them to do anything.
It's just like in Canada lately with the Iran protests, you'll see the Canadian politicians up there talking about how Iran is bad and stuff, but they won't add the IRGC to the terror list. They're letting them bank in Canada. Like, it's the same thing.
Bro,
all these
even,
countries
don't
are
even
hypocrites.
Get me started on Canada right now on the IRGC. Shit is so, it's a fucking disgrace. But I actually had a question for you, Kevin. And this is going to be quite a bit off topic, if that's all right, John.
Sure.
But so one thing I'm interested in is how is the Taliban dealing with opium and the opium trade right now? Like, are they still growing it? Are they still, like,
great question,
trading it? Are they still, like, have they paused? Is this whole thing where they're saying they're going to ban the sale just a ruse to, like, artificially raise the price? Like, what are they doing? I have no idea.
They're banning the sale to artificially raise the price. Yes, they did this actually.
That's what I heard. But
Omar took power, the first thing he did was ban opium for a year, raise the price to an astronomical level, and made 10 times the money.
Yeah. No, you nailed it. Nailed it.
Is it still technically banned, or are they just selling it again? Are they going to wait a little longer till the price goes up?
No, it is bought and sold in the open. So there is no restriction on banning it. But the only thing that changes is that now it's monopolized. In the beginning, everybody had a share, like all the farmers.
What's interesting about opium is that kind of works like gold here, where if the currency destabilizes in Afghanistan, regular people will buy a brick of opium to hold it for dope dealers because it's more security than the money. Well, that's how it used to be. I don't really know what's going on anymore.
To your point, there is one interesting thing to add. This is actually an excellent question. So during the first rise of Taliban, I'm talking about like 25 years ago, and also during the last 20 years, Taliban had several sources of funding. Obviously, some funding was directly coming from outside countries, but a big source of their funding was also coming from opium trade. What was happening was like all the farmers who were cultivating this poppy crop, they would pay a tax to the Taliban. See, this is the hypocrisy of Taliban. If they are really going by the book of the religion, all intoxicants are strictly forbidden Islam, including alcohol. If you compare like heroin and alcohol, which one is worse? You know, they are allowing heroin, but they are, oh, this alcohol is like, oh. And the other interesting thing that happened was there is this guy, his name is Bashir Nurzai, and he is an Afghan drug kingpin, just kind of like Pablo Escobar of Afghanistan. And he was in U.S. custody. He was actually serving a life sentence in the United States. He was released to Taliban, and Taliban had a very, very, like, you know, grand reception for him. And just for Bashir Nurzai to come there, and Bashir Nurzai was basically the main financier. You know, I would say, if you say the Taliban is a corporation, he was the CFO, chief financial officer of the Taliban 1.0. And he is back. And guess what? The Taliban have now banned all the small mom and pop kind of farmers. And now it's all in the hands of one monopoly. And the price has risen so high of the raw materials that Taliban are already making millions of dollars because they knew what they were doing. It's just like a publicly traded company. You know what your plans are. So you buy your shares ahead of time or you sell your shares and then insider information. Obviously, they were planning all of these ahead of time and they had accumulated a large number of these raw materials. And then now they control the cultivation. They control the selling. They control the supply. One thing that they were missing was the person who would be exporting this to the European market, to distributors. And that missing link was released by Drug Enforcement Agency, DEA, back to Afghanistan. Thanks to him, now they are back in business.
The use of drugs in Afghanistan, a lot of people have asked me, why don't we just go in there and destroy the opium crops? And the thing is like, if you look at Vietnam and Agent Orange and all the pesticides we use to like destroy their drugs and food, and just imagine if we attacked the food supply of Afghanistan, because these same fields that grow these flowers also grow wheat and stuff. So there's no way that you can actually battle the cultivation of this flower.
This is not Afghanistan's problem alone. The consumers are engaging in complete hypocrisy. The West is not doing its bit to cut down consumption. The West must either have the courage to legalize use of drugs or to enforce its security apparatus. We need to turn the searchlight on how is it that tons of heroin are making their way to the West, despite billions and tens of billions of dollars of expenditure on security. There must be breach. So they need to start strengthening their own security, or they need to come to terms.
As Ghani points out, opium does have valid medicinal uses, and the crop could become part of the legitimate economy.
For some sections of Afghanistan, we must explore legal cultivation. India is growing it legally, France is growing it legally, Australia is growing it legally.
Kind of tying into it, another thing I actually wanted to ask was, I've seen a lot of photos and videos out of like these quote unquote like Taliban like drug rehab centers, where they and it's like it's actually really fucked. They're like shaving these guys' heads, they're like spraying them with hoses, and it's all this really really messed up stuff. I wanted to get your fill on that. Is how common are these rehab centers, and like are they expanding, or is there only a couple of them? Who's funding it? Just kind of a general rundown on those, if you know anything about
it. So there was a report. It was a report run by a nonprofit agency who had a secret camera brought into exactly these inside this facility, one of these facilities where they kept the drug addicts. And the situation was beyond horrible. There were literally people dying. Nobody was taking care of them. There was literally corpses lying and nobody was even picking them up. So Taliban are taking aid from international donors. I don't have accurate information on this. There could be somebody who is funding them and they may be taking the money for this project but doing their own thing. Kind of just taking it from the street. But somebody was making a comment the other day that Taliban may use them for their suicide squad, in the future. So who knows?
I've been thinking about, you said that all intoxicants are forbidden under Islam, technically.
Yes.
So I've heard many interpretations of this. I've spoken to Muslims about this before. A lot of people just seem to, at least in Australia, it's more like interpret it yourself. A lot of people I find do stay away from alcohol. However, like marijuana and stuff like that is not so looked down upon. And I know that in Afghanistan, the is it black hash, something like that. I'm not exactly sure what it is, but I've...
Like, scholars around the world still haven't even come to a conclusion about medical use of marijuana yet. So, marijuana is not allowed, Jack.
The thing is that it doesn't say anything about selling it, is what the Taliban would tell you.
Yeah, they probably would say some shit about that.
That's what my question was getting to, because a lot of... Whether the interpretation itself is there or not, surely the selling of the product would say to the Muslim world that the Taliban are not, I guess, true Muslims, or I don't know what the term would be.
Exactly, yeah. As I say, like, practice what you preach. And the Holy Quran, the only intoxicant which is specifically named is alcohol, which is stated that this is forbidden. And things like heroin or coke or like hardcore stuff, those are like no-brainer. Those are forbidden. However, there are scholars. So the thing is with the religion of Islam, you know, whatever was said or the rules like 1400 years ago, not everything will apply today and today's age. So that's why you have scholars coming up and say, hey, based on our needs of society, for example, internet wasn't such a thing, or we could say lots of things. And for alcohol, even selling it is also forbidden to non-Muslims. But in terms of the medical use of marijuana, the scholars say, hey, this is allowed because this is something needed. Actually, like the very medicine that puts somebody to sleep while doing the operation is a drug. So if it has a medical use, it is allowed. And also like the weed or hash, it's not very looked down upon in our culture as opposed to alcohol. You know, it's the way it is.
Do you think that's because people who get high as opposed to people who get drunk are significantly less belligerent? Do you think that has something to do with it? That back in the original interpretations and the writing, do you think that the belligerent nature of a drunk has something to do with the specific mention of alcohol?
Probably that could be one reason, just because specifically like hash is not mentioned in the Holy Quran, like this is forbidden and only alcohol is. I'm not like an Islamic scholar, just to give you the accurate information. However, there are some people like in the Sufism Islam who would say, I smoke hash or they do this. It's kind of like, you know, getting to an ecstasy kind of experience or stuff like that. But as far as its religious standing, I don't have like all the knowledge to say, hey, yes or no. But I would say it's a questionable area, a gray area, 100%.
I want to get into hash real quick. At least all the like religious scholars that I had growing up always said that the recreational use of hash was like explicitly forbidden. However, I have heard like certain Sufi, more like less hardcore imams kind of say it's okay for like kind of like spiritual breakthroughs. They'll say that about psychedelics as well. But the thing I actually just wanted to chime in on real quick is what the trade to non-Muslims, drug trade to non-Muslims being okay. This is actually like kind of right out of the Islamist like militant textbook, because you'll see this with Al-Qaeda, you'll see this with the Taliban, you'll see this with ISIS. As far as they're concerned, anything that funds the jihad and anything that like poorly affects European and Western nations, i.e. like drug usage, it is fine to export it because it affects them in a like quote unquote negative way. And it helps fund like, you know, their activities, for lack of a better term.
This is, you know, one other example of their twisted Islam, you know, that whatever suits their interest, you know, so this is allowed. I don't believe, you know, if it is not allowed to use it for yourself, you cannot have it on other people.
It's in a lot. It's like straight out of several, like you see this in a lot of books that like Al-Qaeda writes about, like how to do, for lack of a better term, like how to do jihad and stuff like that. They say like, the sale of drugs to Western nations is the perfect way to like fund it, because it's like, you know, it makes them addicts, lazy, affects them poorly, and like destroys their countries, and we make money off of it. It's kind of messed up.
You know, they may have learned it from the opium war of British and China, where, you know, British was by force selling them opium and then buying tea until they stopped, say, we don't want your opium anymore. Then there was a war. So why you don't want my opium? So, but no, you know, politics is one thing. You know, in politics, politics is dirty. You play all the dirty games to get to your objective. There is no morality. You just go to get to your means. Religion is based on morality, you know, all of that. And there is a saying of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, it says that you are not true Muslim unless you like something for others which you like for yourself. So if you do not want this bad thing for you and for your country, for your people, and you want it for others, then you are not a complete Muslim.
You know, where there's chaos, there's profit. The Taliban likes the chaos because they can advance what they want, their form of government. And the drug people want chaos as well because they can advance their personal desires and needs and economic goals, you know. So I think really what you have is that, you know, these two things, they're just bedfellows, you know. They're working together because they have to advance that. I don't think they're necessarily linked at the hip, but again, I think it's to their advantage to work together.
You pulled up the article for it.
It's so funny.
Yeah.
Well, just to stay on this medical topic and drug topic, because it's kind of interesting. Do the Taliban care about mental health care? Like, do they really care? Like, if someone's having a mental health crisis, are they just gonna like let them go nuts on the street, or are they gonna like be like, well, we need to get this person off the street and get them help, or do they just put a bullet in their head?
If we talk about mental health, believe me, right now, I could say maybe a majority of the country already suffers from mental health, at least from depression, anxiety, stress, and PTSD, and you name it. Imagine I speak with people in Afghanistan, with the teachers, female teachers, female students. They cry, they are depressed, their morale is low, they don't have hope for future. There is even nothing on TV to watch. Taliban banned everything on the TV. They cannot go to park. They cannot go to, you know, we call hammam, is where they have public baths. They even banned that. Like, every is just like locked in essence. I would say there's like millions of people suffering from mental health right now.
It reminds me a lot of like when with Mao, how he came to power, how like the ancient Chinese culture that had such a rich history, the first thing he did was kill the culture of China.
And no, actually,
well, okay,
John,
so yeah. Do you think the Taliban's scared of women?
Yes. Taliban are scared of women. One thing that has changed in the past 20 years is women are also not scared of Taliban. We have seen in the protests, you know, the brave girls, not only in Kabul, but also in Paktia, in Mazar, in Herat, in even in remote places and provinces in Afghanistan. They, against all those, you know, they firing bullets, beating them, and everything, they go out and protest, demand their rights. And Taliban, they know this too well, that only an educated girl can do this. No woman who is uneducated will go out on the street and demand their rights. And that's why they are afraid of the schools and universities, because imagine, if you have in a country where all the women and men, they are all literate, they are all educated, would they accept people like Taliban to be their rulers? Obviously not. because they know better. But if they did not go to school and they are ignorant, they have no education, they would say, hey, you know, whatever Taliban says must be true, you know, because that's the only people they know.
With America, we have Americans are very ignorant. And so they'd be like, well, maybe they should teach these women how to use guns. Maybe the people should fight back and all that stuff. Mm. There's this very live free or die attitude by people who have never fought for anything here. Mm. So I wanted to just dive into that question is why don't the women learn how to fight with guns against the Taliban?
Actually, women were in the army, you know, during the Republic, the 20 years. We had women who took up arms. They were in armed forces. We had women who were pilots, fighter pilots. We had women who were in the police force. We also had women in the army, in the leadership roles as well. So, you know, with the fall of the Republic, obviously everything fall apart. But one thing is that with, you know, currently the situation is quite different than what it used to be. What many people say is eventually the fall of the Taliban will be at the hands of the women.
That's, I mean, look at Iran right now. And somebody who's a friend of mine, but he's a Taliban supporter, that's one of the things, a point that he made. And I was like, that's actually a pretty good point, is like that the Iran protests are, it's the Taliban's worst fears. Mm-hmm. And so it's like it inspired them to do even more crackdowns against women.
Did the situation with the girl at the University of Kabul a couple months ago, Aleha?
Yes,
did that get any traction in Afghanistan, and what was the reaction domestically?
A very good question, and actually, Jack, thank you for asking this question. So we all know the story of Ilaha Dilawarzai. She was a medical student. And the official spokesperson for the Ministry of Interior, whose name is Saeed Husti, he abducted her, you know, raped her. We know all the story. She released a video exposing all the crimes that happened to her. And even at that time, she was at the custody of the Taliban when she released it. She had gone through so much trauma, so much torture. She was even pregnant when she released that video. And then she managed to escape to Pakistan. And there was this group, Human First or something like that. I don't recall exactly. Disclosed the location of Ilaha to the Taliban, and who brought her back to Kabul, and she's now in custody. And to answer your specific question, inside Afghanistan, nobody in Afghanistan can talk about this. They will be in big trouble if they bring up her name even. Even the TV stations, like that are like all the news stations that are in Afghanistan, not a single of them mentioned her. And not even, you know, it is one of those things that Taliban strictly control the narrative around that issue.
That was our article on it, because we did a full breakdown and spent a couple weeks on it, I think, and then we sort of
So like we found like the earliest, we found that she was making reports way back in February, that she was trying to get people's attention way back in February. So we found reports of that, and we basically did a lot of tracing up to it. But the only issue is that none of us speak the language. So,
yeah,
you know, you can only do so much.
Yeah.
So,
but I think we did get Human Rights Watch to pay attention, which is good.
Yeah, a big part of it was the parody account of Ashraf Ghani.
Yes.
He was a huge, I don't know if it's a guy or a girl who runs that account, but they helped translate the video with subtitles that we hosted. And that video was shared a lot in English audiences. So it was all his idea. But we did work together on it.
So. Yeah, so it was a collaborative effort, but we did as much as we could, and then we lost track.
Well, we lost track because we knew that she was giving out, and I know, and that was one of the things, is that we couldn't say anything because we knew that she was, and like, that's the thing, is just she should have been evac'd. We know that she has family in this country. We talked to family in a certain country, and she was supposed to be moved from Pakistan, and we know that her driver, whoever was working for this organization that has a shady history that I won't really get into, the driver took a picture of her, and that's the picture that the Taliban had when they came for her. There's definitely something going on. How do you get out of the country without a Haqqani's permission? How do you cross that border without a Haqqani knowing about it? I just wanted to say that, you know, that girl is one of hundreds of women who are experiencing the same exact thing. She was brave enough to come forward, and, you know, we rarely have people come forward about rape in our country. You know, it's only a small percentage of women who are victims that come forward. So for somebody to come forward in Afghanistan and be as detailed as she was extremely brave. And it's one of the bravest things that I think I've seen anyone do. So,
and apparently that video was even longer, and the original source of it cut it down. So there was more to that video. I think
ours is 15 minutes long. Is cut down just because it's like we only have so much time because somebody was subtitling it for us. They have a full time job, you know, they can only edit so much. پدر من یکی از جنرالای ریاست عمومی امنیت ملی کابل بود. قاری سعید خستی سخنگوی وزارت داخله بازور و جبر دمای دل و وقت سخنگوی برآل بودند در داخل ریاست استخبارات امرای من نکاه کرد. من بسیار رده کوب شدم. طوری که به یادم می آید. ده اون چه بالن من تجاوز شد من همی فهمیدم چی کنم اونو از من فلم گرفتن سعید خوستی از من فلم گرفت من تعدید کرد که فل من نشر میکنم مره به کارهای بسیار زشت وادار میکرد هر شب بالای من تجاوز میکرد هر شب مره لدگوب میکرد بعد از نشری ویدیو شاید من دیگه هیچ کسی نبینم شاید من بمانم اما هزار بار مردن که نه یک بار مردن خوب است فقط میخوای من نجات بدی
Actually, the question I wanted to ask, since we've kind of gone over the opium and the hash trade, real quick, outside of funding from outside countries, what would you say are the Taliban's top 3 to 5 forms of, like, funding themselves outside of whatever assistance they may receive from other countries?
So right now, the one funding is obviously the domestic funding, the taxes that they collect. So one thing that Taliban have started, that's actually a very good question. You know, besides from the all the customs, you know, import duty or export or stuff like that, which is now minimal because the trade is very limited because of non-recognition and all of that. So trading activities is low. What they do is they tax everybody, everyday people. Like all the residents of Kabul, they received a letter, you know, asking them to pay huge sums of taxes on their properties, which they never had to pay before, like this huge amounts. Like these taxi drivers, you know, they are standing, like they are taxing them, you know, everywhere they stand. So they are like just basically rip off like everyday people. That's like one thing. And the other thing is there are all these big contracts that they do. For example, they had the big contract with China on the mines or selling coal and these things. There are like all
what about
these...
the supercar?
Yeah, supercar. That's a different thing. But that process started 5 years ago. It just finished now. So it's not a Taliban achievement. But The other is obviously we talked about harsh drug trade, but all the aid that is coming to, you know, $40 million, there is no transparency in terms of tracking the money, where it goes. Taliban are controlling that who the beneficiaries would be. They are excluding former army personnel or army government employees from those aids, and including their people. And obviously, all these things, in the black market, things get sold out. And even when they first took over, there was huge cache of ammunition and weapons being transported towards Pakistan, which was only a very small fraction of it were stopped at the border, which they were showed, but a very large, even heavy duty army vehicles, they were sold. That's another source of their funding.
Yeah, like people are talking about all the weapons left behind to the Taliban. And I was like, most of that shit is broken. And they're just going to sell it for parts. Like if you look at, they would be posing with like a helicopter and there'd be a big hole in the engine block. And it's like, come on guys, you're falling for propaganda here. It's like, to think that the army didn't break their vehicles before they left is just ridiculous.
Yeah.
They have new stuff from Pakistan.
And give it a year or more, all the vehicles that they have, their parts will be breaking and they won't have spare parts.
That's how we do it in the army.
Yeah.
What about you? Is there anything that you wanted to talk about that didn't come up? Colleen? You personally? Is there anything that you wanted to talk about that we didn't talk about?
First, thanks again for this opportunity to speak with you all. One thing that I would say is that Taliban is just one of the several tools used by Pakistan to, get influence in Afghanistan. And Taliban is not that, if tomorrow Taliban are gone, I am 100% sure that they will have somebody else in the store, which they already have, like the ISIS group that they, from time to time, they blow up themselves here and there and making their presence known. And Pakistan double play has been so obvious to everybody by now. And, you know, yesterday they were using Mujahideen, today they are using Taliban. If Taliban are gone, they will be using somebody else. So our main problem lies across the border over there with the ISI, you know, what they are cooking for Afghanistan. That's the main issue.